Okay, well, welcome to the winter wonderland as Wellington. You start by saying the country's experiencing some very uncharacteristic weather in certain parts of it. I can't personally ever recall seeing snow in downtown Wellington. My wife tells me there is snow around our house, or at least there was for a short period of time in Auckland, so it's very unusual. And the main message really to New Zealanders is just to be cautious and be a little bit careful. Make sure they keep an eye out for their family and friends, and if they are aware of their neighbours living alone, might be a good idea just to check up on them and make sure everything's okay. It's certainly been a thick blanket of snow in certain parts of the country. I want to start by talking today about new technology development grants, if I can. I'm announcing the second round of technology grants that we launched in Budget 2010 to boost research, science and technology funding for New Zealand companies. You should have in your hands a press statement from the Minister of Science and Innovation, Wayne Mapp, outlining a total of $50 million worth of grants to 19 high-tech exporting companies. The first round of technology development grants was awarded in December 2010 to 26 businesses, which received a total of $92.6 million over 3 years. The aim of these grants is to help high-tech exporting businesses. The research, science and technology package announced in Budget 2010 was all about investing in New Zealand's future. The budget, as this year's did, focused on building faster and sustainable economic growth, which is the only way we can create the jobs, higher incomes and better living standards that New Zealanders deserve. Investment in research, science and technology will help us achieve that aim. The grants in the latest round range from $300,000 to $5.9 million and go to manufacturing, biotechnology, medical technology, electronics, agri-technology, software development and other companies. More detail are in Dr. Map's release, including the list of firms getting grants. The importance the government attaches to research, science and technology will again be emphasised later this week when I open the new offices of the Ministry of Science and Innovation in Wellington. Today I'd like to announce that to recognise the anniversary of the first Christchurch earthquake, Cabinet will meet in Christchurch on Monday the 5th of September. This will be the first time Cabinet has met outside of Wellington in 16 years. The last was in 1995 when Cabinet met in Paihia during the Waitangi Day celebrations to commemorate the 155th anniversary of the signing of the treaty. Christchurch Mayor Bob Parker, Waimakariri Mayor David Ayres and Selwyn Mayor Kelvin Coe have been asked to brief Cabinet on the day. There will also be briefings from GNS, EQC, Tonkin and Taylor and CERA. Ministers for the Earthquake Recovery, Gerry Brownlee, will then join me at post-Cabinet press conference. The Cabinet meeting will be held at the Copthorne Commodore at 11 a.m. on Monday the 5th of September. This will be followed by a press conference at the same venue or at the earlier time of 2:30. So that's Monday the 5th of September. Just briefly in terms of welfare reform, many of you were at the National Party's annual conference over the weekend. I'm sure you've seen all the announcements I made about targeting our disengaged young people. As I said in my speech, I make no apologies for the hands-on approach we intend to take. It's important to note that many of the young people who will be affected by the policy we outlined yesterday are not actually on benefits yet. They are 16 and 17-year-olds who have left school but are not in education, training or work. These kids are, however, on a collision course with a benefit as soon as they turn 18. That's why we're going to intervene to get them back on track. Many of these young people need education and training before they're going to be work ready, so we're focusing on getting the skills and knowledge they need to get a job. Just in terms of Sir Paul Reeves' state funeral, as I announced earlier today, the state funeral for Sir Paul Reeves will be held on Thursday in Auckland. I will be attending along with a number of ministers and MPs from across the House. The state funeral is scheduled for 11 a.m. Thursday the 18th of August at the Anglican Cathedral of the Holy Trinity in Parnell, Auckland. In terms of my activity this week, tomorrow I'm at caucus and question time. On Wednesday I'm opening the new Ministry of Science and Innovation office and attending the state lunch and farewelling the current Governor-General, Sir Anand Sathyanan. On Thursday, as I mentioned, I'll be attending the state funeral for Sir Paul Reeves. And on Friday I'm in Ngarawahia at the anniversary of the coronation of the Māori King. When the House resumes tomorrow, I'll move the House express its condolence at the loss of former Governor-General Sir Paul Reeves. Following that, the government intends to move the first reading of the Legal Assistance Amendment Bill and the second reading of the Biosecurity Law Reform Bill. The government then intends to move that urgency be accorded to the passage of a number of bills that require timely implementation. That's it.
Can I just ask you, the government and the previous one spent about $200 million over the last 3 years on schemes to target youth unemployment and so forth. Does it show, it's quite a bit of mess, does it show that it's actually not working, those schemes, and it needs a complete rethink by the government, the bio-officials?
Yeah, well, I think what it shows is we spent a lot of money in the past and we haven't got great results. And I think it shows that we also need to have a greater level of intervention. It's one thing to provide support for young people, and that's in the form of cash. No one's arguing about that. But what it also shows is that we actually need some entity, somebody to be walking alongside these young people and really giving them a complete wraparound service. And I don't think we can underestimate how important that is. These are 16 and 17-year-olds who are disengaged from education, work or training. By definition, many of them haven't had a parent in their or an adult in their life for a long period of time. They're often raising a child and they need support.
So you can see that those schemes in the past, I'm talking about community banks, that sort of thing just happened for a big failure.
I don't know. I think if it depends on the particular schemes. There's a variety of things. I mean, things like Community Max, actually, and Job Ops were actually quite successful in terms of transitioning people into work. I don't think in entirety they've been a failure, but we're trying to address different things here. I mean, one is about job employment, and that's important. So it's making sure that these young people can ultimately be work-ready. But the second thing is actually about the number of people on benefits in New Zealand. And they are related, but somewhat slightly different things. I mean, if you look at young people, I do want to make a point about that. One of the things that's been running around is these numbers of how many young people are actually out of work. And as I said numerous times in the last 24 hours, there is a big difference between the Household Labour Force Survey, which literally surveys young people aged between 18 to 24 and asks them whether they're looking for a job, in which case if they indicate they are looking for 1 hour's work, they are deemed to be, for the purposes of the Household Labour Force Survey, looking for work. They may well be at university. They can be at school. That does not mean they're unemployed. Those on the unemployment benefit aged between 16 and 24 is a much smaller number. It's actually 16,540. And that number is dramatically lower than it was. If you go back to the early part of January 2010, that number was roughly 23,000. So a fair bit we've done in that area is actually working. But we're talking about significant reform so that the long-term structure of welfare isn't dominated by people who come on at an early age and stay there for a very long period of time.
Why don't we just make it that no one under 18 can be on
benefits? Yeah, so obviously the bulk of people are not, and that's why, as I said yesterday, if you think about it, the bulk of people that the policy went out yesterday doesn't affect them in terms of being beneficiaries. It's about the sharing of information and then the wraparound provider going to work with those young people who aren't actually on a benefit. And that's because legally at 16 or 17 they're a minor, and therefore the responsibility of their parent to be supported, and generally are. The reason we can't with the group of about 2,600 people is some of them are invalids and will be there for a long period of time, probably their life on invalids benefits, so the state supports them. And secondly, for the others, they're usually no longer with their parent. They're usually no longer living at home, and so they need financial support.
Do you believe that a 17-year-old going out because of their first day of work should be able to earn the same as an hourly rate as, say, a 50-year-old in the same factory or the same job?
In principle, yes, except there's already a training allowance at the moment that may apply for that young person, getting slightly less. I mean, historically, we have had youth wages as a way of enticing young people into the workforce and as an inducement. I'm not saying that they can't work. I'm just saying that they are a factor, but if they are the only factor for taking on a young person, is that they're financially more viable because they're a little bit cheaper. I worry about the longevity of that job, because I think it might help, but it's really there's got to be a lot of other factors for taking on that young person.
Phil, obviously it's discrimination to people who have youth
rates. I don't think it's discrimination. I think there can be a place for them. There's currently a training rate. We're looking at that whole issue in total, and we'll come back to you well and truly before the election. I'm just simply saying that is one factor, but not every factor.
When you look at a car, like you're going to use those young people, so that they don't have.
Yep.
would you consider rolling that out for other groups, as possibly as a punitive measure if they're not having the finance as well, or if they have problems with their money, such as gambling or alcoholism or whatever, would you consider rolling that out for all?
You see, at the moment, voluntarily that takes place, and some hardship benefits are currently paid on that card, although the time limited, the beneficiary has to use them within 4 days. But voluntarily, some people do agree to do that because they actually don't trust themselves with their own money, or they're really struggling to budget, and they know that that's an effective way of making sure that they can achieve that. Look, we haven't considered that as a measure for other age groups and other beneficiaries. We see the 16 to 18-year-old group as a sort of special, unique cohort on their own, simply because of by virtue of their age and their lack of life experiences. This is the group that we think will work the best.
Because the welfare group, working group, did recommend using a car for people as a sanction,
yep.
So that if you don't meet your obligations, you
yep.
would just start management of your income.
No, I don't think we'd say we're seriously considering that. Look, we've got to work our way through the rest of the report in due course. I mean, I actually think as a model for the 16 to 18-year-old group, it'll be highly effective. I mean, really what we're saying here is, look, there are some basics that need to be provided for when you get an entitlement from the state. They are your rent, they are your power, and they are your basic food. And I think most New Zealanders actually, frankly, would support us in that movement. Now, as people get a bit older, generally, you know, we try and work with them more hands-on in terms of budgeting services and the likes, but look, if we would make any other moves, we'll consider that in due course, but it's not something that's on the agenda right at the moment.
In terms of the 16 and 17-year-old, in 2006, the ministry essentially toughened up its approach for it, and there was much more involved in the hands-on case management for those yep. young people. But, I mean, since then, though, has there been evidence that's failed, and that just evidence simply that they are frittering away that money, that it's not going on paying rent?
Yes, so anecdotal, we haven't recorded data so much in that space, but anecdotal evidence that, A, they are struggling in certain instances, and that's actually seen by the welfare grants that we provide. But also secondly, I think one important factor here is that these are typically young women who are looking after a baby and are 16 or 17, 18 years of age. And I think they are seen as a source of cash and are preyed on by less scrupulous young males. And I think that the risk here is that you've got a young girl, she's 16 or 17 years of age, she's got $400 or $500 of cash coming at her, she's vulnerable, and she's got a male entering her life who sees that as a source of cash, and we want to take that off the table.
What about the increasing role that you want to see from organisations, well, essentially the private sector? Is that something that you think could be rolled out further, beyond just the youth area?
Yeah, I think so. Well, let's see, but if you think about the concept of what we're talking about here in terms of the wraparound providers, we're thinking about a third of the payment they get will be a bonus for achieving successful outcomes of the targets that we set them. That means a young person not necessarily ending up on a benefit or making sure they attend their parenting, drug or alcohol course, training course. And I think that incentive-based payment system's worked well in Australia, and some evidence we have is it's worked well in Scandinavia and other parts of the world. So I don't think you always need MSD as the delivery mechanism for that.
Are you going to have enough staff on the front line for this, so you're going to have to employ more now?
Yeah, no, we will, because you've got to remember, for the most part, actually, this is being outsourced to the Waipara Trust or the Presbyterian Support Services.
Have you ruled out getting young mums?
So that broad issue, Cabinet needs to consider that, and we'll make a decision about the age that we think people should return to work when they're on the DPB before the election. So there's a number of options available, obviously.
Should it go lower?
Well, I don't want to really speculate on that today. What I would say is we need to consider that issue, and there's a number of factors to weigh up there. The reason why we didn't need to consider it really in terms of this group is you're talking about mums who are 16, 17 or 18, so realistically it's not really affecting them at this point. They are likely to transition to the full-time domestic purposes benefit, but we made some changes, as you're aware, in terms of work testing, part-time work testing when the youngest child is 6. Cabinet's in the process of considering if there would be any other further changes, and again we'll come back to you very soon.
Presumably the main factor you need to consider is whether you would invest in the early childhood care that would be required for those families to go back to work?
Depending on where the age is set, yes, that's one factor.
Should we take some sort of an indication, though, of where you might be, your thinking might be on this, and the fact that you think a one-year-old baby, it's okay, in fact, it's optimal for the mother of that child to be in training? I mean, is there a big difference between being in training and being in work?
It can be. It depends on the training course that the person's doing. I also think it depends on the situation. I mean, there's about 500 young women at the moment who are in teen parent units around the country. We're looking to expand those. We know that we can't provide enough of those for every young mum that's in that situation, but we do think we can provide some training courses that can accommodate the responsibility of looking after the child and the bond between the child, but also the need for that education. So that group's, you know, a little bit different because they're younger. We're not trying to force people back to work unnecessarily. I mean, we acknowledge that, you know, mothers will want to stay with their children, but I don't think the moves we've made so far in terms of part-time work testing of age 6 are unreasonable, and we'll look and see whether we'll go any further on that in due course.
These grants they give, yeah, some like the what was the evidence that they worked last time?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, again, you need to go and talk to them, but some of these companies are proving to be very successful. I mean, OpenCloud is an example of one that's here today. Funnily enough, just completely by chance, in the buildings they are, I ran into a guy who works for RJ Hill Laboratories. It's the Hamilton company that's got 1.376 million. I've never met the guy before, but he literally came up to me and said, look, I just want to thank you for the grant. We've expanded our workforce, we're taking on more people, and we're doing more research. So I think, yeah, at the end of the day, this is a 20-80 split. So we put in 20% of the research grant, they put in 80%. So these are companies that are serious about investing in R&D. You've got to remember, Labor want to get rid of these grants. We don't. I completely disagree with their view that R&D tax credits are the right way to go. Actually, all they will provide is a reclassification of existing expenditure. This is real expenditure.
Aren't you just picking winners here, though? Because, I mean, who's to say that these are more deserving than another company?
Yep, so by definition, everybody goes through and puts up an application, and so you have got a panel that has to choose, you know, who's in, who's out. You only have a couple of options in this space. One is ultimately you have a fixed amount of money in an allocation process, or you have an open-ended process like Labor is proposing. But Labor's process is costing $800 million. It'll largely see the reclassification of existing expenditure, and therefore, by definition, it's open-ended and can cost you anything. And I don't think that's very effective myself.
You guys will be monitoring the companies in the first round.
So. Yep. And they're here for you all to ring up and go and see. I'm sure you'll go and do your own due diligence.
So have you had reports on how well they're doing?
Only anecdotally myself, but I'm saying doing pretty well. I mean, it's early days. I mean, R&D is a long-term program. I mean, and it won't always work. I mean, by definition, some of this stuff is blue skies. But, you know, we're putting in 20% of the money. They're putting in 80% of the money. That's a serious commitment from those companies. Can't expect them all to work.
Just on your welfare study you looked at on the weekend.
Yep.
You're obviously going to roll out something much bigger than this at the beginning of the election campaign or something. Is that what you're signaling?
Well, let's wait and see. I mean, the issue of welfare reform.
It's only a couple of thousand people here.
Yeah, but
the issue's much wider than that.
Well, I think if you look at the overall group that we're targeting, it's about 20,000. Because you're really talking about 4,000 people in that 16 to 18 year old group. You're talking about another sort of 14 odd thousand that are hopefully are going to be stopped from going on to welfare. As I say, 90% of them otherwise will end up in welfare. But sure, yeah, I mean, there's 328,000 New Zealanders of working age on a benefit, and that's an awful lot of people, and we'd like to see that number smaller for their good and for the overall cost of the state. So there'll be more reforms.
Is there a country that you've looked at when you studied this and just looked at it that you think, yeah, they've got it
about? No one's exactly the same. So when we looked in the weekend about exactly the policy that we rolled out there, we couldn't find a country that was identical, but we found lots of countries have individual parts of that. Certainly what we saw in Europe and Scandinavia is they've tended to take a more hands-on approach now for young people. So they're not all exactly the same, but Denmark's done some stuff that was interesting. We had a look, I think Norway or Sweden's done quite a bit in this space. From memory, there was, I think, Holland's done some stuff. There was a number of countries that they gave me on the note I saw. They're all a bit different, but they have produced better results, I believe.
I mean, I guess it comes back to jobs again. I mean, and when, you know, during the earlier in the 2000s, when the economy was booming, the number of beneficiaries had dropped to about 250,000.
Yep.
They basically off the back of economic growth. I mean, And that's really the main driver.
I don't know if that's entirely correct. I mean, obviously, you know, a stronger economy that's soaking up people into the workforce absolutely helps your unemployment benefit numbers and, at the margin, some of your other numbers. But actually, there was a very steady and consistent growth in the number of people on invalids and sickness beneficiaries numbers over the course of the Labor government last 9 years, and DPB numbers were fairly consistent at around about 100,000. So what we saw when we made changes like Future Focus, where we put in a very simple test about re-registration for someone that had been on a benefit for 12 months or more, was that we actually produced quite good results in terms of the number of people that didn't reapply. And so, you know, therefore it wasn't required by definition, the fact that they didn't reapply. So, yeah, I mean, I think obviously a stronger economy will help, and that's why we've got the economic plan, that's why the government's, you know, enormous amount of time is deployed in trying to have policies that will create economic growth. But there's more to it than just that. I think it's about the point I made yesterday, that you judge a society by the way it's looking after the vulnerable, but you also judge a society by the amount of dependency it creates. And I think, you know, our welfare system is creating dependency in some cases.
Do you think paying people bills for them and restricting what they can buy is encouraging independence?
Well, I think what it's showing very clearly is that we are not going to be in a situation where we're just simply going to give them money and abandon them. I think the payment is one issue, but if that was in isolation, maybe it would have some impact, but not as much as you might think. But you put a wraparound very full on provider working with that young person. You do a number of other things about getting them into work and training. Then it's, you know, it's a different model. And I think it's really important, actually, that everybody understands what the welfare system is. And it's a system of mutual obligation. You know, the state has a responsibility to look after people, to care for them, and make sure that they can look after themselves. But actually, the welfare recipient has a responsibility to make sure that money is used appropriately. If you're a young person bringing up a child, your responsibility is to make sure that child is fed, is housed, and is warm. And I'm not going to make any apologies to anybody for ensuring that that happens to those young people. I'm sorry, but I don't care if it offends a few people. What I care about is those kids. And this is going to make sure they do have a house. It's going to make sure they have warmth, and it's going to make sure they have food.
Are you concerned at all about the potential for private organisations to actually broaden this system, particularly if you're looking to expand it?
Well, again, we have an enormous number of private sector contracts which MSD already engage in, and they have different levels of freedom, if you like, in terms of how successful they prove to be and how trusted they are in terms of their overall delivery. I mean, for each individual person, I think the payment we're talking about is in the order of between about $2,000 and $3,000. So again, yes, in due course, you'll be well and truly aware as the media of who gets those contracts. I'm sure you'll be monitoring how successful they are, like we will. So if providers don't deliver, they'll be sacked. Yeah, so that's one thing we've been working on with MSD in a number of areas to try and make sure that our monitoring is improved. Look, we'll have some clear KPIs. I mean, how many of these youngsters go on to a benefit when they're 18? How many of them complete their drug and alcohol courses? How many complete their education training programs? The level of deprivation we see with these young people, there's a number of measures we can use.
Do you have your own goals? The number of people that should be on welfare? So let's say you win the next election and you've got 3 years in office. Do you have a target of the number of people on welfare that you would like to see?
Not in my head, but personally, preferably less. And the reason for that is that, you know, if one looks at the sort of economic support that is provided to these people, it's quite low. I mean, relatively speaking, that's the reason why we have so many youngsters in poverty.
Is 10%
too ambitious? 10% less? I don't know. It'll depend on a number of factors. But I think we can get to a welfare system that has clearer obligations on both parties. I think we can get to one that is more effective, and I think we can get better outcomes.
When you look at the expenditure on welfare, about $24 million,
yeah,
40% of that is on super.
I know.
So, you know, the DPB is what, 4 or 5, and that's eight. Other forms about 4 or 5. So really the bulk of it is superannuation. That's something that they're not prepared to touch in terms of their age of entitlement. So when you're looking at actual savings from the welfare system, you're ignoring the elephant in the room.
Yes, officially, look, I might be wrong, and stand correct off the top of my head, I thought the overall cost was about $16 billion, of which about $6 or $7 billion was superannuation, about $9 billion is the other benefit entitlements. Firstly, I don't count superannuation as a benefit. I think it's an entitlement. I mean, it's completely universal pay to anyone aged over 65. So on that basis, I would see it as a benefit. And, you know, look, the kind of perennial issue of whether the age of entitlement should rise or the generosity of the scheme should be reduced, I mean, it's an interesting debate, but actually, you know, I've made my position clear on it, and, you know, from my perspective, I think, you know, A, it's important I keep that trust with the New Zealand public, and secondly, the most important thing I can do is actually make sure the economy is strong so we can afford to pay all of the other bills that the country has. Even the Retirement Commissioner, by her own admission, says it's not an issue we need to tackle before 2020. Well, I've got a lot on my plate between here and 2020.
But wouldn't break a promise to sequel something that might take effect from 2020, is it?
It might not. But like I say, there's so many other things the government has to focus on at the moment. That's not one of them.
Are you convinced that the private sector's got the capacity to provide these wraparound services for?
Well, my experience of when the government puts up cash to provide and ask for the provision of services, providers meet that requirement, and they'll often change what services they were engaged in to engage in others. So the answer is yes, I do. I believe that we're there.
Is a cash bonus system almost an invitation for these providers to focus on the easier kids and getting them into easier training to pass, perhaps the risk of ignoring the harder cases or getting them into training courses that are harder to pass?
At one level, you'd probably say none of them are easy, in so much that if we just take the raw stats, 13,500 of them not engaged in work, education or training, and 90% of them likely go on a benefit, then by definition all of them are in quite a difficult space. And that was one of the reasons why the government tackled this issue first, primarily because it's a tough nut to crack, but it's one that we need to make progress on. Look, again, it won't work for everyone, we acknowledge that, but if we can do... We've got to be able to do better than 90%. And so, look, I think overall they'll be allocated on the basis of probably the location that they're in as much as anything else, not just picking and choosing the actual individual names. They're unlikely to know the individual names. It's probably even more an area.
You seemed pretty confident on Q&A yesterday that the US was heading for a considerable period of growth with low inflation. What made you so confident about that?
Well, my main point to Mr. Espiner was that just because... they've got low levels of interest rates, doesn't mean that they can't grow. My point was there's a lot of capacity in their economy, so that when we asked the chairman of the Federal Reserve about inflation outlooks, he was not concerned about inflation, and that's because if you look at their labour markets, there's a huge amount of excess capacity. You look at their building construction markets, there's lots of excess capacity. So, personally, if you want my view, I think what's going to happen in the United States and Europe is you are going to see a period where they are going to have to take on board the medicine, and that is eventually get back into a more balanced budget position. But I don't think it's going to be instant, and I don't think it's going to be overnight. Personally, I don't think this is 2008, 2009. It feels vastly different to me. As I said to you last week, and I think that was actually vindicated by the fact of what you saw in the markets, 3 up days and 2 down days. And look, I've been in those markets, and I'll tell you now, when you trade in August in New York, it's like trading on the 28th of December in New Zealand. I had 2,000 people on the floor in New York when I was there. You'd be lucky if 150 to 200 of them were there in August.
But if they're going to be
there's a very volatile market. So you've got program traders pushing the markets around and real money accounts basically sitting there on holiday in the Hamptons.
But if they're going to be taking that medicine, surely it means stagnant growth for you.
Yeah, but not necessarily. I mean, you know, we ourselves are sort of cutting our expenditure, but actually overall it doesn't mean the private sector can't pick things up. I mean,
our government debt isn't 7% of GDP, though.
No, but their interest rates are so low. Actually, their funding requirement of that is next to nil, isn't it? I mean, the yield curve's moderately upward sloping, but not very much.
And then it's hard to find investment, though, if interest rates are so low.
Well, I don't know. You see, that's the issue, isn't it? I mean, all I'm saying to you, I think it's different. We'll see. I mean, in due course, I mean, as I've said, we're not immune to the rest of the world, but just from all the things that I see, we look in a lot better shape. I genuinely think we're in a lot better shape than most other countries. I mean, our unemployment rate's steadily coming down, our benefit numbers are coming down. Australia's kicked up last week.
But the argument is that our exporting partners are not in good shape. We may be in great shape, but we still are vague. We're an export economy, aren't we? And so if they're going to be stagnant for perhaps a decade or very little growth, then surely it is going to hurt.
It's true, but they've been just as stagnant in the first quarter of this year and we grew at 0.8%. So, yeah, look, there's no getting away from the fact if the US and Europe are in better condition and they're consuming more and their consumers feel more confident, then that helps us because that helps global growth. I'm not arguing against that. But I'll tell you now, the one I worry about is China. If there's a problem in China, then worry, because that's what affects Australia and that's what affects New Zealand. But all the numbers we see on China at the moment, for the most part, are still very, very robust.
So Australia doesn't worry?
Well, Australia's 100% correlated to China. Go and ask their macro forecasting team at the Reserve Bank. About half of them in the Australian Reserve Bank are focused on China. That's because that's their market. So look, in the end of the day, I'm not saying these other countries don't matter, but huge amount of growth coming out of Australia is fueled by what's happening in China. A big part of our market is China and Asia demand in general. And overall, we still see a very strong picture there. I mean, that's why we've got this big focus on China, on India, on Indonesia, on Malaysia, and on Asia in general, to pick up some of the slack that we're possibly hurting us in the US and Europe.
Peter Goodfellow apparently indicated 47% was...
The 8, I think.
48% was National Party target. Is that your view as well? You think it's a good target?
I don't really have a target, to be honest, a numerical one. I mean, I just want to get the biggest party vote that we can. I mean, I think the point he's simply making is if we polled 48% under historical terms, that would be enough for technically National to have a majority because of the wash-up. And we actually polled 45% last time, but had 48% of the parliament. Now, that depends on lots and lots of different factors. It wouldn't stop us doing deals, by the way. I mean, it would still be my expectation that we'd want to at least have discussions with other leaders and probably enter into confidence and supply agreements. But it would just mean that sometimes if we wanted to pass something and no one else wanted to support us, we could go and do it. And, you know, that's the factor. But in the end, I mean, every party leader wants to get the maximum party vote they can. I'm not in a unique position. It's just that we might, you know, achieve a higher poll than some others will.
Do you think there's any complacency?
To be honest, I think it's probably more the opposite. I think the delegates were very conscious of the fact that there's a lot of work to be done. And I don't see complacency in the party. What I see is everybody is, you know, absolutely critically aware of the importance of that election. I think they know that, and I know, elections are really hard fought. You know, we're not stupid around the National Party. We saw Labor go on at 50% in 2002 and they polled 40%. You know, lots happen in, you know, a week's a long time in politics, a month of an election campaign's an awfully long period of time. You know, I think we've built up a lot of trust and a lot of confidence from the public, but in the end, they're really going to focus on those last 4 weeks.
Will you be campaigning during the Rugby World Cup? Or do you
not really.
Yeah,
political black zone, really. I mean, real, I hope it's an all black zone. Basically, the long and short of it is, yeah, I mean, I'll just be going about my normal activities, normal business, but the House rises, I think, the 6th of October. You know, there'll be appetite for stories if they're good enough, but in the end, I'm sure a lot of them will be dominated by what's happening with the Rugby World Cup. I mean, we have a week where people will leave the country post the final, and then it'll be full on with the campaign, you know, into the campaign launch and into the debates.
So you wouldn't be announcing any sort of initiatives at all through
that? I wouldn't completely rule it out, but I'm just sort of saying that, you know, we continue to operate as a government full on. I mean, our view is, look, 3-year cycle is actually really short, and we've got to do everything we can. We owe it to the New Zealand public to deliver the best results that we can, so we're not slowing up in the slightest. You know, I'm sure there'll be announcements along the way, but I think just generally the focus of attention will be the Rugby World Cup for that 6-week period, and then it'll be the election for the next 5-week period.
Mr. English seemed to take a few jokes that we were expecting. Are you worried that didn't mean other than good nature?
Not in the slightest. Poor bugger has to put up with me doing it all the time. No, look, he's in great form. So. Thank you.